You know, each year, thousands of trout, walleye, and salmon are released into the Great Lakes. They're part of the DNR's decades-long stocking efforts. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry, who's just taken a few days off. And we're talking about fish stocking in the Great Lakes. Joining us is Bradley Eggold. He's a Great Lakes District Fisheries Supervisor at the DNR. Do you fish in stocked lakes? Tell us your thoughts about stocking. What have you noticed about fish populations in a lake or stream near you? Join in 800-642-1234 or send us an email. It's ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Brad. Thanks so much for joining us today. Brad, are you with us? Oh, Brad just dropped, so we're going to have to kind of, well, we'll dog paddle a little bit until we get him back out. He was really nice enough to join us, and he was at a, I think he's at a conference or something like that, so he wasn't quite sure if he was going to be able to join in, but we did catch him, but apparently someplace where there's not a great signal, so we'll be taking a look at that. But so talking about stocking fish, have you ever stocked a fish pond of your own? We'd like to hear about that. What works, what doesn't work? What about fishing in the Great Lakes? Are you happy with the fish that are there now? Are you looking for others that are maybe getting fished out? Love to hear you on that, too. 800-642-1234. And Brad is back with us. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today and for getting us back on so I didn't have to talk to myself for a while. I appreciate that.
No problem.
So why are fish stocked in some lakes and streams and some aren't?
Well, what the department tries to do is, stock areas that, make sense with the species for that body of water to hopefully provide, augmentation to the fishing that's going on in that body of water. And really the ultimate success is that, we're stocking fish in there that maybe are low numbers or something else is going on there. And we hope that by stocking, especially, inland Wisconsin, that then those fish take off and provide some natural reproduction, and then we can not stock there anymore and move on to some other body of water.
So what kind of research then do you do beforehand to make sure that when you put these species in that you're not, harming other existing animals or the body of water itself?
Yeah, on the Great Lakes, we have sort of a long-standing stocking record with Pacific salmon, and that really came about to us in the Great Lakes due to the large number of alewives that came in from the Atlantic Ocean, back in the 30s and 40s, and trying to utilize that food resource, we turned to Pacific salmon to, use one introduced species to try and handle another exotic. So sort of a different situation on the Great Lakes where we thought they would create a fantastic sport fishery and at the same time utilize some of these alewives that were washing up on the beaches and shores back in those days. And it's certainly done both. We've done a great job of putting in these Pacific salmon. It's a tremendous fishery, especially in Lake Michigan for that. And we continue to stock, where necessary in the Great Lakes to continue some of the great fishing we've had.
How is that research conducted? How do you know where they need to be or if there's too many?
Right. Yeah, usually right now, whether you're talking about any of the Great Lakes, they have a pretty robust sampling program, not only with the state agencies, but our partners at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Geological Survey, the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, and a lot of tribal governments, where we're all looking to kind of assess the forage base. What kind of forage do we have? What's the composition? In fairly accurate terms, how much do we have? And then we try and put out each and every year sort of the fish that eat those fish or the predators on those fish in the right numbers so that we are, just at that sweet spot, providing a great fishery but not depleting the forage so that we can have fishing moving on 3, 4, or 5 years down the road.
It's kind of tricky, isn't it, balancing all that?
Yeah, especially I've been recently talking to people, and it's really hard for people to grasp and visualize, especially when you're on the water, you can't see it. It's not like you look at a piece of land and see corn growing or some other crop where you can easily count it or see it. You know, it's all underwater, so it takes some pretty sophisticated equipment to assess the populations of forage fish. And our partners at USGS do a great job every year on all the Great Lakes, looking at these small fish, both with a gear that kind of captures them out of the water. We call it a trawl. And they also use a sophisticated hydroacoustics gear, like your sonar and stuff you have on private boats, but obviously a lot more robust, mm-hmm. where we try and look at what we're seeing, how many are we seeing, analyze that data, and come up with a tonnage of forage that's out there in the Great Lakes.
So what percentage of the fish that you're stocking is done for, you know, recreational purposes as opposed to environmental?
Right. Yeah, the vast majority of the things that we're stocking in the Great Lakes are, you know, geared for sport fishery. So, you know, we stock a lot of salmon and trout, obviously. We are stocking some Great Lake spotted muskie. One species that we're more of on a rehabilitation theme is a lake sturgeon, where lake sturgeon were very prevalent around the turn of the century, but obviously their numbers were severely depleted at that time. So for sturgeon, we're mostly on a rehabilitation arc where we don't allow fishing in most of the Great Lakes bodies of water as we try and augment their fishery population.
What about commercial fishing? How does that play into it?
Yeah, the commercial fishers, you know, are mainstay in the Great Lakes. You know, we've been working with that industry for, you know, 100 years or more. And we work with them to obtain the necessary data. And then just like with the forage fish, you know, what's the sustainable level of the targeted fish that they're catching? And then eventually we set these target harvest goals and quotas for the commercial fisheries of Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, so that we're comfortable with the number, they're comfortable with the number, and that if we have a harvest of that poundage, that will be sustaining for many, many years in the future.
Mm-hmm. We've got a call from Thomas in Manitowoc with a couple of questions. Hi, Thomas. Go right ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest. I live on the Manitowoc River, and as far as I know, there's no natural reproduction of the salmon there, and mm-hmm. I see, you know, thousands of them coming up the river in the fall, and they're all dying. Does anybody ever talk about potentially netting those in the lower part of the river and processing them to can and maybe distribute them to people that have a lower income? Because I just look at the millions of pounds of fish that go up the river by my house and seeing them all going to waste. And then the other question I wanted to ask was, at one time you tried to implement a program to plant some sterilized salmon into the Great Lakes that wouldn't reproduce and potentially gain a gigantic size, being that they didn't die in 4 years. Is there any new technologies on the horizon where that could possibly happen again?
Okay, thanks, Thomas. Brad?
All right, I heard like three questions in there. I'll go for the first one. on the Wisconsin side of Lake Michigan, we have very limited natural reproduction, and it really stems from the type of water that we have in terms of it's a little bit warmer and, you know, fairly turbid at different times of the year. So while we get some natural reproduction of the salmon and trout in selected streams, certainly up in Two Rivers, East and West Twin probably have a little bit, and some of the other rivers there. But in general, most of the natural reproduction that we're seeing for these specific salmon are coming from the Michigan side. They've got cooler streams, sort of streams that run through vast forest tracts of land, and they produce some of the smolt. In fact, our project looking at Chinook salmon reproduction, we're finding that about 65% of the salmon that are in the lake are naturally reproduced, which is quite a bit different than what people thought as few as 15 years ago. So we are seeing all that happen. Secondly, that has never really come up in terms of these fish going up. Obviously, we do plant them in rivers and harbors so that they do come back to these streams. They imprint on them and then hopefully provide a fishery for anglers in September, October time frame to catch them. But yeah, nothing really has ever come up in terms of utilization like Sam was talking about. And then the third part is, yeah, we did try it was called a sterilized Chinook salmon program, where we tried to artificially sterilize Chinook salmon. The thought was that they wouldn't put any energy into reproductive gametes, and that they would grow to, you know, really super trophy size. And that really didn't work out. We saw a lot of the fish returning. They actually were mature, so the sterilization didn't work, and we really didn't see any large fish from that production. And that was probably back in the 80s, and we haven't really tried to do it again since that time frame.
Okay, great. Thank you for those wonderful questions, Thomas. We appreciate that. The history of stocking goes back quite a few years, doesn't it?
Yeah, when we it definitely originated in Michigan waters. And if you go back, it's very fascinating to go back in the history of stocking, particularly in Lake Michigan, where some really forward-thinking biologists over in Michigan said, hey, we got to try and deal with these alewives that are, you know, super abundant. And they looked at a variety of Pacific Coast fish and settled on, you know, Chinook salmon and coho salmon as the two ones they would import. And the thought was they would thrive in the lake and provide a fishery at the same time taking care of the alewives. So we learned from that early on in Wisconsin, built some hatcheries, got a salmon stamp going. And then by the late 60s and early 70s, Wisconsin began their own stocking program for these fish in Lake Michigan. And sort of the same thing occurred on Lake Superior, where it's a little bit different ecology up there. They have more, because of the water quality and that, you know, more native populations that have hung on compared to the lower four lakes. But we still do some augmentation stocking up there, particularly for Wisconsin, with brown trout and splake to provide a fishery, you know, near shore waters of Lake Superior.
Okay. We're talking with Bradley Eggold. He is the Great Lakes District Fisheries... Supervisor. There we go. Sorry, I missed that one. What are your thoughts on stocking? We haven't heard from a lot of you, so give us a call. 800-642-1234. Or you can give us an email, too. ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the news. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about fish stocking efforts and focusing in on the Great Lakes. Our guest is Bradley Eggold. He's a Great Lakes District Fisheries Supervisor at the DNR. Tell us about the time that you've spent fishing on the Great Lakes. What are your thoughts on the stocking that's been done there for decades? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can send an email to us at ideas@wpr.org. And Brad, let's just go right to the phones. We've got a couple of people who called in. Jeff in Jackson, it's your turn.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question. In the 80s, we had some tremendous lake fishing on the east and west Twin Rivers, up into rivers and down along the lakefront in Milwaukee. Are you guys getting back into the program of ever possibly stocking more of this lake?
Go ahead, Brad.
Sure. Yeah, we had a fairly, you know, modest spike stocking program, and it was primarily centered around Green Bay to take advantage of the different forage that's in the bay compared to the lake. And even with that said, we saw some returns, you know, back to harvest, but not a lot based on how many were stocked. Probably 20 the ship returning fish, like, you know, Chinook and coho and rainbow, and haven't been stocking spikes since that time, mainly because of their, you know, higher cost and lower return rate compared to the other fish that we're stocking.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that call. Speaking of Green Bay, let's go to Mike in St. Louis. He has a question about that area. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, my question is, it doesn't have anything to do with salmon or trout, but it seems like recently in the last couple of years, the whitefish population has really ballooned, and they seem to be foraging on the zebra mussels and the quagga mussels. And I'm wondering if whitefish were at one point scattered all over Lake Michigan, or why do they seem to be limited to Green Bay? And my second question is, if they are indeed eating these invasive mussels, which tend to be killing all the perch and all the other baby fish, can we start stocking those in the southern portions of the lake?
Okay, mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, the lake whitefish is sort of an interesting tale of two cities where, you know, out in the lake, due to really some strong year classes of whitefish, meaning, good in a number of years in the 80s and 90s, that we had a lot of whitefish, out in Lake Michigan and was very both mostly commercial but also sport available. And then because of those high numbers, it looks like the fish then sort of got into Green Bay, and then they utilized resources in Green Bay, like some of the rivers as well as some of the reefs in Green Bay, to sort of repopulate Green Bay.
Yeah, we're having a little problem there, obviously, with our phone connection. So I think we're going to switch to a different phone with Brad. So we will be back with him in just a second. In the meantime, we do have an open line. If you have a question or comment about stocking the Great Lakes or other bodies of water around the state, the number is 800-642-1234. Or again, if you have a question, you can email it too, or a comment. And that address is ideas@wpr.org. Okay, I think we have him on the phone again. I think he's ready. Nope, not quite ready to go. Okay, thanks. I'm getting the no, we're not ready from Tyler. So sorry about that. We do have him. Okay, we got the thumbs up. Hi, Brad, you back with us?
I'm back with you.
Okay, thanks. Go right ahead. I think you were in the middle of answering a question there. Oh, did we lose him again?
I'm still here.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah. So we've got a lot of fish in the bay, and commercial fishers and sport through the ice are taking advantage of those whitefish. And it's really sort of in the bay because they're utilizing the resources there, and not that many out in the lake. So the numbers are down, certainly in Lake Michigan proper, mainly to the same reasons why we see other fish struggle. And as the caller pointed out, it's due to a lot of invasive species, most notably the zebra and quagga mussels. But this is something that we're not going to be able to, stock our way out of the problem. If there's no food for the fish that are there, then stocking fish aren't going to, resolve the issue.
Okay. Thank you for that call. Matt in Madison emailed us kind of something along those lines. He was wondering what percentage of fish that we're stocking are actual native species, because he wasn't sure that native salmon are native to the Great Lakes. And if that's the case, why did we pick certain non-native species to succeed?
Right. Vast majority of the fish that we're putting in Lake Michigan and Lake Superior are these Pacific salmon and trout. And so there are some, like we do some lake trout up in Lake Superior in limited fashion, as well as lake sturgeon and a Great Lake spotted muskie. So those are native fish. And then the other ones are the Pacific salmon and trout that people know, Chinook and coho salmon, rainbow and brown trout. And like I said previously, we started that program in response to having them utilize the abundant alewife that were found in the Great Lakes.
Okay, thanks for that email. Next we go to Perry in Oconto, and he's got a question. Go ahead, Perry.
Yes. Hey, Brad.
Hey.
Question is, we're doing this stocking for fish and stuff, but I don't hear anything about the fish accumulating the PFAS in their bodies and then transferring it either to other fish that eat them or to humans that consume the fish. And from what I heard, one meal of fish, and it affects pretty much all species, is like drinking PFAS water for a month. I don't see any advisories up at the boat launches either.
Okay. What about that, Brad?
Well, I know we have a, you know, fairly, you know, robust sampling program, and we have for, you know, decades on looking at contaminant levels in Great Lakes fish. So we're under a, you know, rotation of fish every year that we submit to our, you know, state lab of hygiene for sampling, and then we update our Choose Wisely advice booklet on the department's website as often as we get new data. So that's really the source for people to go, and we are starting to integrate, you know, PFAS information into those booklets. So if you go to our website, dnr.wisconsin.gov, and then probably search for Choose Wisely, you'll come across our fish advice on terms of not only PCBs, but mercury, and now we're starting to integrate PFAS as we learn more about that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that question. John in Milwaukee, what's your question for us?
Brad, I would just like to know why we don't have many yellow perch in Lake Michigan anymore. I see when I buy them, they usually come from Lake Erie. They have the same quagga mussels and zebra mussels. So what's the problem?
Yeah, that's really, I mean, it's unfortunate that we have this lower population of perch. And if you look at over the long term in Lake Michigan, it's really been sort of boom and bust scenario for perch. And we were coming off some phenomenal year classes of perch in the 80s that really drove the fishery for much of the 80s and middle 1990s. And then some of these invasives comes in and really alters the food web. And as I say in response to this question a lot, it's really hard to be a small fish in Lake Michigan. It's very challenging. It's very food limited now with these fog mussels chipping out a tremendous amount of organisms out of the water. And combine that with our, you know, not as much input from nutrients that some of the other lakes enjoy, particularly Lake Erie, that we just don't have the production to produce the food resources for, you know, fish like perch. They still remain, you know, in the Southern Basin, and that's what we saw sort of when they're in a lower amount. They sort of retract down into the Southern Basin where it's a little bit warmer, a little bit more productive waters. But unfortunately, even with our fairly strict bag limits and no commercial fishing for yellow perch in southern Lake Michigan, we haven't really seen a bounce back year classes of perch, unfortunately.
Thank you, John. He also was curious about smelt. I mean, I remember years ago, they were just so thick you could almost walk across the water.
Right.
What's going on with them?
Yeah, it's much the same thing where, you know, these food resources that these small fish need early in their life is now being consumed by quagga mussels in particular. And then they're running all the energy that was currently, you know, in the water column is now being concentrated on the bottom of Lake Michigan. And that's where you have, you know, fish that normally thrive in the water column are not doing well, and other fish that are more bottom orientated are doing okay. For example, the whitefish, as we mentioned earlier, you know, they are utilizing some of these mussels that we have there. Unfortunately, they don't produce a lot of energy for whitefish. So we have seen whitefish weights come way down. Like a 5-year-old whitefish used to be way heavier than it is today. And that's because they had a nice fat and juicy forage to eat back then. And now they're trying to survive on eating these mussels. And I sort of akin it to if all we ate was rice cakes, we wouldn't get very big either. So, and that's what they're trying to survive on. And, luckily, they are surviving, and they're reproducing. They just aren't getting the weights that they used to have.
Mm-hmm. Quite a problem for sure. If you've got a question or a comment about stocking our Wisconsin waterways, give us a call, 800-642-1234. We do have a few lines that are open. Brad, we got an email, he called but couldn't stay on the line. It's Larry in Janesville. He wants to hear about the Rip River Station in Racine. Can you help him out with that?
Yeah, the Root River Station.
It could be.
Okay. Yeah. We have a couple of collection facilities. As we mentioned earlier, these fish obviously are pre-programmed. We stock them and we try to put them in streams and harbors, and then when they reach maturity, they find their way back fairly accurately to where they were stocked. And so we utilize that behavior, and we have a facility on the Root River called the Root River Stealing Facility. We have one in Kiwan County called the Bisadne Anadromous Fisheries Facility. And then we have a third facility on a small creek that runs into the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal called Strawberry Creek. So these three places are where every fall and spring we collect the eggs and fertilize them for the next generation of fish. And we do that down mainly from September 15th through like November 15th at each one of these facilities. We've got some nice web pages. Both facilities on the Kiwan and Root have open houses in the fall, usually in October. Bring your kids there to see what we're doing, grab a fish, hold it, see what the system's all about. It's a great learning education. And on a good day, we can get 1,000 people or more to each facility during our open houses.
Oh, that's cool. So there's a website where you can go to find out when those are going to be?
Yeah, you could probably just go to our...
Oop, we're getting garbled again. Still there, Brad?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to try to switch phones with you, Brad. So hang up and we'll call. We're going to the landline. I'm not sure. So anyway, thank you all for your patience with this. It's one of those things that we have to deal with when you're working on live radio, I should say. And Todd and Peter, we will get to you as soon as we can. So we have that coming up and we're dialing Brad right now on a different line. So hopefully he'll pick up on that. Just to let you know, tomorrow, John Freiberger is going to be with us. Every other month, he's here to talk about home improvement. Changes out with Chad Spate every other month or so. And this time, we're going to focus in a little bit about leaks. He said he's gotten a lot of calls with some of the driving rain. So we'll talk about that and, of course, answer your questions. Now, let's go back to Brad and talk about fish. Hey, Brad.
Hey, I'm back.
Yay, you sound much better this time. So fingers crossed.
Right.
Go ahead and finish your thought there.
So I think if we get to, dnrwisconsin.gov and then and search for, Root River Steelhead Facility or the Sadney Anadromous Fisheries Facility and or Fisheries Open Houses, we not only have them at these collection facilities, but we also have opportunities to take tours of our hatchery system in general. So they also have some of these open houses throughout the year, and it's an excellent educational opportunity to go visit one and see what raising fish is all about.
Excellent. Thank you. Let's go to Todd in Wapaka. Thanks, Todd. What's your question?
Hello. How are you doing? I just would like your thoughts from you and the listeners on German brown trout being planted in brook trout streams because they eat all their food and they eat the brook trout.
Okay, Brad, go right ahead and tackle that one.
that one, I think he's kind of referring to some of our inland trout waters where we are, we're stocking, brook trout as well as brown trout, and I think even some rainbow trout. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to defer to others on that one. I'm not up to speed on some of the issues surrounding that kind of stocking, unfortunately.
Okay, because you really focus on the Great Lakes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Peter in Madison, you're next.
Thank you. All you told us that you're stocking these predatory fish, the salmons and the trouts and whatever, but they're starving. From what you're telling us, they're starving. So what is being done about providing more food? I mean, obviously the mussels, our Great Lakes are not productive because the fish is starving. What are you doing about it?
Okay,
yeah, that's what we're doing is that every year with our partners I mentioned earlier, we're assessing the forage base and we're looking at the number of fish that we're putting into the water, and when necessarily we've made adjustments, both increasing stocking and we've also decreased stocking, sort of a match the predator versus the prey that we have out there. So right now we're currently in a fairly good spot in terms of the salmon and trout that rely on these alewives to eat. We're getting good reports the last several years of good, healthy fish, fairly robust size. a lot of over 30-pound Chinook are being reported in the fishery. So it seems right now we have a fairly good balance between the available forage and the fish that get put in there for the fishery in Lake Michigan. But you're right. Some of these others that don't rely on alewives that are eating more some of these invasives or native forage items, if those numbers are down, yeah, they're definitely, you know, lower weight than they had been in the past.
And it's not like you're not doing anything. You're definitely trying to figure it all out, right, Brad?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some things where we can manipulate stocking numbers to make sure we have the right number of fish compared to the forage is one thing. Some of these other larger scale environmental influences that we've seen where, for example, they mentioned earlier that the lake whitefish used to eat a small amphipod called a diaporia. And it lives in the bottom, a lot of fat, a lot of high energy for the whitefish. But here come the zebra and quagga mussels. And if you look at charts of the density of these animals, it's gone almost to zero in areas that used to have tens of thousands per square meter. So when you lose that kind of food resource for these whitefish, they're going to struggle. And unfortunately, there's not all that much that can be done about it. They are adapting a bit, and they are going after some of the other forage items, and they are eating some mussels, but the nutritional value of a mussel compared to diaporia is not even close.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that question up, Peter. John in Green Bay area, you are next. What's your question?
Hello. Say, hey, listen, aren't you guys concentrating more on, like, walleye? Because these huge, big walleye tournaments bring in a lot of money into the area. And doesn't the walleye just gobble up all the smaller fish, like the perch and the smelt, to get big and fat?
Okay, thanks, John. Brad?
Yeah, we've really seen an interesting, we'll say, a sort of a flip in species, particularly in Green Bay, where we had a bay that was really dominated by yellow perch back in the 80s and 90s, and we had tremendous harvest of perch, both sport and commercial, at that time. And then through some of the stocking efforts, and a lot of it kind of traces back to also the Clean Water Act of 1972, where a lot of the inputs, particularly in Green Bay, that were thwarting fishing and fish survival, you know, we turned the corner on that, and now we have a Green Bay that there's a lot of walleye biomass and less perch that they are eating some of these yellow perch. So now we have a situation where we have a, you know, pretty phenomenal walleye fishery in the bay and a decent yellow perch. But as the caller suggests, you know, the big fish eat smaller fish. And right now the walleye sort of has the upper hand there in the bay.
Okay, thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Stephen Appleton, you are up next.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the distinction between trout and salmon. My understanding is salmon is saltwater and freshwater fish. How do they survive and thrive in the Great Lakes, and what's the distinction between a lake trout and a salmon?
Okay, thank you, Steve. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead,
yeah,
Brad.
Good question. Yeah, the salmon, they're all like Pacific-run fish. So the salmon, we have coho and chinook, and those have a distinct end-of-year life pattern. So when they mature and they swim up streams, it's a one-way journey, and they'll end up dying at the end of that spawning journey. And that can happen in the case of coho as early as one-year-old fish, but more appropriately 2 years old. And then for chinook, it's mostly 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old chinook that swim up our streams, attempt to spawn, and then that's the end of their life. That's different than the trout species, where they can make many spawning runs and go back out the lake. They don't, when they're done spawning, they don't end up dying. So the brown, rainbow, and lake trout have that kind of reproductive biology compared to the salmon.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Steve, for that question. And thank you, Brad, for being with us. I know it was kind of a touch-and-go thing there. We appreciate your patience with being with us.
No problem. I'm glad we finally got back several times and happy to be on the show.
And hopefully we'll have you back on again. We've been talking with Bradley Agle. He is the Great Lakes District Fishery Supervisor at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Join us again tomorrow. John Freiberger will be back to take your home improvement questions. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well.